Luciente said. She was lying in bed with a doctor going rounds and cracking jokes for the amusement of his residents over the bodies of the women patients whom some female troubles had cast up on this hard white beach, this glaring sterile reef. They were handed releases to sign, carefully vague, so the residents could get practice in the operations they needed. In the bed next to her was a 19-year-old black woman on welfare who'd been admitted for an abortion in the 14th week and been given a hysterectomy instead of a saline abortion. The woman had gone into withdrawn shock, which made her a quiet patient. Nobody bothered about her as she stared at the ceiling. The women with syphilis were treated to obscene jokes. All the doctors ever said to any complaint was, "We're giving you some medicine that will take care of that." They did pelvics and rectals 7 or 8 times in a row on interesting cases, so all the residents could get a look, all the time explaining nothing. "You're a very sick little girl," the doctor said to a 40-year-old woman whose intestines they had accidentally perforated in removing an embedded IUD. Anger began to blur the scene, and she moved closer to Luciente for support, then feeling the ground solidify again beneath her. Suddenly, excitement blew like a wind through the tent. "Bolivar is down," Jackrabbit cried out. A bell began to toll. "What's the bell?" she asked. "For death," Luciente said. "But she isn't dead yet." "Person soon will be," Jackrabbit found. "Pepper and salt, it's not always bad to die, is it? Who'll want to be built of steel and go on living when all the people born in your brood or in your time, all your men's and mates and mothers, all your sweet friends had long since gone down?" Connie snorted and turned away. The bell tolled through the damp air in waves of heavy sound. Slowly more people began to drift into the tent, keeping away from the side toward the floater pad. Finally, she heard a high-pitched warning siren, and a fast-moving vehicle came shrieking toward them about a foot off the ground. It came to an abrupt halt right outside the tent and settled with a hiss. White Oak hopped out, and a person, the voice had been male, she thought, about 5'9", compactly built, slid out the other side and strode with quick, slithery grace toward the tent. Bolivar, she supposed, had hair worn in braids fully as elaborate as Erzulia's, but his skin was fair and heavily freckled with the sun. He wore a knee-length, she could not call it anything but a dress, with stripes on the bias. Luciente nodded curtly as he swept by. "Erzulia's been holding Sappho for you." "Why not you? You could have," he rapped out, "not with a person from the past in tow." Briefly, he glanced at Connie, his skeptical eyes pale gray and cold as rock. Then he rushed to the cot, embraced Jackrabbit briefly, and put his hands on Sappho's head beside Erzulia's hands. After a moment, Erzulia seemed to come to, and slowly her grip loosened. She rolled off the cot onto the ground. Everyone had drawn back to leave Bolivar with Sappho. He held her head with his fingers flexing, moving, and then, for the first time in a quarter of an hour, her lips groped to form words. "Good. Here. Good," was all she said, and then in a hoarse shudder she expelled her breath and was still. Bolivar rose. "The person who was Sappho is dead." Jackrabbit spoke to his kenner ceremoniously, repeating, "The person who was Sappho is dead." The bell tolled more slowly. Barbarossa dodged through the gathering people carrying a plank. He laid it on the ground, and Luciente moved forward to help Jackrabbit and Bolivar lift Sappho from the cot and place her on the plank. White Oak and Aspen, shaken from weeping, turned to each other to embrace. Bolivar's knuckles were clenched white on Jackrabbit's arm. The freckles on his hands stood out like the blotches on aged skin. White Oak steadily stroked Aspen's cropped head. Jackrabbit was one of the four people who lifted a corner of the plank and began to carry Sappho into filmy strands of rain. Aspen's thick-grown hair lay like a bouquet of shiny grasses wedged under the small claw hands folded on Sappho's narrow chest. Aspen, White Oak, and Bolivar stumbled along behind the body, White Oak walking with her arm around Aspen, Bolivar going along ahead of them in stiff dignity, as if the only joints in his body were in his bare knees. Luciente fell in behind them with Connie. "Where are we going? To the undertaker?" "The family, the lovers, the closest friends sit with the body to loosen the first grief. After supper, everybody in the village will gather for a wake in the big meeting hall where we politic, watch holies, hold indoor rituals." "When is the funeral?" "Funeral," Luciente consulted the kenner. We have no such. At night, we stay up together speaking of Sappho. Then at dawn, we dig a grave and lay the body in. Then we plant the mulberry tree Sappho wanted. Someone will go to the tree nursery and marry in for one. Then before we go to bed, we visit the brooder and signal the intent to begin a baby. Right away? That's heartless. One in, one out. Why heartless? In a week traditionally, when we are caught up on work and sleep, we discuss into which family the child will be born and who are to be mothers. We begin by meditating on the dead. It just seems cheap somehow. No funeral, no undertaker, just shovel them in. Connie, your old way appears barbaric to us, trying to keep the rotting body, to pretend we're not made of elements ancient as the earth, that we do not owe those elements back to the web of all living. For us, a good death is one in age without much pain and in clear mind. A full life is a used life. Persons should be tired. You sit in on the wake with us. You'll see. It feels beautiful. It feels good. You'll see what beauty. I myself will perform tonight with my drums, which you should get before we set up in the meeting house. Something's wrong. She felt a threat shaking her. Let go, Luciente. Let me go. With haste, Connie. Luciente stepped back and Connie faded through into the chair in the dim day room. Nurse Wright was slapping her to and fro till her jaw ached. Please, Doc. Thought you'd withdrawn. I feel real funny today. I think I slept or passed out the medication. I felt real funny after I took it today. I think I'll stop.
Oh, okay. The contrast between those two worlds is so incredible.
But there's nothing in that world except the suspension of disbelief for us to be the brooder that we really couldn't have. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the way they live, it isn't like I made up a real exotic world. Most of the ideas are current somewhere, in people striving for social change. Now that's what I was trying to do, is create
right.
an image of, I suppose, what I like out of all the ideas that you've produced.
It is. It's the ideal world that people striving for social change are trying to get to.
It's not even ideal.
But so much of it is. Sappho dying with such no fear. She's not afraid. She's dignified. There's no question that she has a total feeling of self-respect and there's respect for her instead of disgust and fear that people here in this world now have for people who are dying. It was a beautiful death. And later in the book you describe the death of Jack Rabbit.
Who died young,
and it was sad that he died.
Yeah. And where there's a harsher grief.
There's a harsher grief.
And there has to be, Rosalia has to take part, but she has to loosen. That's one of her skills, is the ability to loosen that.
Loosen the grief and let people express the pain and feel it. But even when Jack Rabbit died, and there was a lot of the people who had been close to Jack Rabbit expressed pain at losing.
Yeah, there's the wake. Yeah, I do the wake that time.
Right,
exactly
you do it.
Do
the one that Connie couldn't stay for this time.
That wake comes. One of the people I live with was once at a Maori wake, it struck me from the description that they had the sanest way of dealing with death that I'd ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really adapted from that. The wake that they have, where they start out with them. They all sit up all night together. It's really an account of what the Maoris do at a wake, where they stay up all night and they start with the very sad songs and people. I'd never been to one, so I adapted it freely, but mm-hmm. the basic idea was that reason. Mm-hmm. People get up and they speak their suffering and people weep together. Mm-hmm. And then as the night goes on, you get more and more the reminiscences and things get a little bodier and they get a little funny. And finally, by morning, people are feeling lightened.
And they're not...
The whole night of intense feeling being expressed. They're really lightening. And by morning, they're singing kind of body songs.
Because they're releasing their feelings instead of holding them in. And they also release negative feelings. I remember very well with Jackrabbit that there were people who expressed negative feelings, anger at him, things that he had done that they had not liked, that they felt that he had been inconsiderate and disrespectful of them as persons. And it was okay. It wasn't this precept, if someone is dead, you can only speak well of him. If they had things to say about him that weren't good, that was okay too. Because they were things that they had experienced of him as a living being.
I also didn't think that in utopia that there'd never be... In other words, it's not really a utopia because it's a good society, but things go wrong. People don't always like each other.
Uh-huh.
You remember there's enormous tension, even in that scene. There's
Aspen?
Bolivar. Well, also, yeah, well, Aspen is, but that's like a thing between lovers. But Bolivar and Luciente don't get on, and they don't get on to the point where it becomes a social problem.
Right, but how is it dealt with? How it's dealt with is that everyone gets together, and Bolivar and Luciente face each other and try to talk to each other, and all the problems of the village, which is the future world, is a small village, a series
it's
of
many, many villages.
Many, many
a lot
small
of people,
villages.
But, yeah.
Right, but it's everything is done collectively. And the collective process is so hard, and yet everything is done collectively. And the community as a whole knows that these two people have to work out the problems between them, and so they sit down and they try to do it. And then in the course of the book, they don't do that well to either.
No.
You know, like there's a child at one point, I think Dawn, Luciente's daughter, who asks her, how is it going? Are you finding things to talk about with Bolivar? And Luciente says, It really is quite hard, except, but we try, you know. What was the one thing that...
They could talk about their childhood. It's about the only thing they seemed able to talk about.
Right.
Into arguments they could talk about.
Right. I wish we had a lot of time to talk about the way that children are dealt with and are handled and live in this world. They, first of all, they're conceived, they're not carried in anyone's body. They grow from conception to birth.
Though there are other parts of the society, I think it's remarked that where people who are women still choose to give birth.
Uh-huh.
But I think it says somewhere that there's one. In other words, it's not entirely unknown.
Mm-hmm.
But in this village, that's the way it's.
Right, and
it's
then
probably the prevailing mode.
And then the child is born and has three mothers.
Right,
and they're all called mothers.
Yes.
So they may be composed, say, of one woman and two men who may be the child's mothers. And then yet still the child does not live in a home, in a nuclear family with the mothers. The child lives in a children's house. But even so, in the children's house is not left there and cared for by one person in the first place. The people who care for the children in the children's house do it because they love caring for children.
Also, at least two of the three mothers breastfeed. So
right.
All three.
Right, and they have their canners, which are like wristwatches that they wear, and they know can tell what's happening anywhere at any time. And when the baby's crying, when their baby's crying, they know it fields away where they're planting, and they come running back to the house to get their baby and nurse it.
But they also carry their babies around a lot while they're working.
Right. And when there are festivities, village festivities, the children are all there.
The children work. From about 7 on, the children work.
Mm-hmm.
Children are, and at 12, you become a full member of the community.
And you rename yourself. You choose your own name.
Mothers are not allowed to speak to you for
3 months. Right. I mean,
and then after that,
I'm really sorry if you were trying to not create a utopia, and I agree with you about the part that not everything in it is perfect. But
society, that's all I wanted. Try to imagine a society that I'd rather live in.
Oh, I would like to live there too, and I found it so sad every time. I have a real problem with books, and that I get so intensely into them. And every time Connie was,
that's the ideal reader.
I know I'm an ideal reader, but the trouble is that every time Connie was dragged back from that society where people really were considered and respectful of each other as human beings, was dragged back to the ward in the mental institution, which was the epitome of dehumanization. I couldn't stand it. I didn't want
to
happen.
Really, but it's really funny. They're always. I swear, every time I write a book, people do two different things with it. Like a small change is that fans divided up into those who were into Beth and those who were into Miriam.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed almost sometimes to me as if there was nobody who was equally into Beth and equally into Miriam. Those who are into Beth liked certain parts of the book, and those who are into Miriam liked other parts. And the readers of this book seem to fall into those who really empathize with the present part of it, the mental institution and what happens to Connie, and are very moved by that and really kind of bored by the future. And those who are most excited by the future like you, who are mostly interested in that, really does fall into two parts.
Oh, no, I must disagree. I love the future, but I'm so moved by the present. And I find that, I was upset every time she had to return to it, but I also felt that what you were doing in describing her present in the mental institution was really, really important and done in such a way that you could really see what happens to people in institutions. And it wasn't, what the future world was happy and the institutional world was unhappy. So therefore I loved being in the future world. I was unhappy when she was slapped back into the world of the mental institution. But I wasn't sorry those parts were there. And as I told you before, I was sorry she wasn't out in the city, in the ghetto, even longer than she was, because I think that's just terribly important, those things that you bring out. In the section, the first section you read where she loses Angelina, I thought it was amazing how clear you made it that she wasn't a bad mother in any way, that it was society and the conditions that made her have to deal with such a thing as where on earth was she going to get new shoes for Angelina, and there was just nothing left that she could possibly do but say, oh, you lousy kid, and smack her, and just because she smacked her too hard, she lost her child, and then her child was adopted out of her culture.
Yeah.
It was just so sad. It was, and so real.
I hope so. I tried to make it real.
Yeah.
I got very into Connie. I like her a whole lot.
I love Connie. I want a sequel. I know you don't do that in
never.
Your books.
Never.
I know, but I think Connie was an incredibly important character to be the protagonist of a book. And I also felt that she was much more than anyone else. I mean, she was very definitely the protagonist.
Oh, yeah.
Lucienti and the others and many others were really important, but Connie was so much the protagonist of the book. I hope that people hearing this program will be moved to read the book, because I think it's a very, very important book. There was one thing that you said early on, we talked about it, and then it was clear in one of the sections that you read about work being meaningful, and I remembered a poem of yours which talks about love, about work and the meaningfulness of work. Do you think that you could find that poem and read it? It's such a relevant poem.
It is To Be of Use.
Do you have it?
Yeah.
That's the name of the poem, To Be
yeah.
of Use. Okay, read us that.
Book of the same name.
Would you read us that?
The people I love the best jump into work head first without dallying in the shallows and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust, but the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry and a person for work that is real.
Yes. Yes. I want you to read other poems too, but can I ask you one question?
Sure.
I heard someone ask it of you, and I liked your answer very much. And the question was something like, how do you write? I don't remember if she said, how do you write, or how is it that one becomes a writer? But I really loved your answer. Do you remember?
No, I don't, but I probably just said you work at it. You just do it.
And that writing is not very different, for example, than laying bricks. And
oh, I did say that, right. Well, it's very mystified in the society. It's like any work you do, the difference is that it isn't, until the product becomes a commodity and is sold, it isn't alienated labor. Then you're in the same position as everybody else. It's alienated from you. It's taken away. It's part of the market economy. But while you're doing it, at any rate, it's because it's work you want to do. It's no different. I mean, that's the only thing about it which is different, is that you want to do it. But in no other respect is it different. It's the same thing. You put things together.
But as you said in that earlier poem, all work should be work that we want to do. And it's just sad that it can't be. What are you going to read us?
Living in the Open.
Okay.
From, again, if you did one title poem, I'll do the next title poem. This
okay.
is from the new book, Living in the Open.
Okay.
One. People ask questions, but never too many. They are listening for the button to push to make it go away. They wait for me to confess nights hollowed out with jealousy. Or people say, isn't that interesting, and believe nothing. I must be public as a dish of hors d'oeuvres in a bar. I must hunt the shrubbery of couches for prey. Loving not packaged in couples shivers cracks down the closed world, the nuclear egg of childhood, radioactive stone at the base of the brain. Can you imagine not having to lie, to try to tell what you feel and want, till sometimes you can even see each other, clear and strange, as a photograph of your hand? Two. We are all hustling and dealing as we broil in the iron grates of the city. Our minds charred, we collide and veer off. Hard and spiny, we taste of DDT, we trade each other in. Talk is a poker game, bed is a marketplace, love is a soggy trap. Property breeds theft and possession, betrayal, the vinegar of contempt. This woman, does she measure up? This man, can I do better? Each love is a purchase that can be returned if it doesn't fit. Hard as building a wall of sand, hard as gathering blackberries naked in the thorny sprawl of a bramble, hard as saying, I've made a mistake and you were right. How hard to love, how painful to be friends. My life frays into refuse, parts of broken appliances, into tapes recorded over, photographs of people I no longer talk to, even on the phone. How loud, too, the clash of my needs in my pockets as I run to you, keys and coins jangling. My hungers yowl and scrap in the gutter. I will ring you for a few drops of reassurance. My fears are telling the beads of your spine. To hear your voice over the subway roar of my will requires discipline. No more lovers, no more husbands, no masters or mistresses, contracts, no affairs, only friends. No more trade-ins or betrayals, only the slow accretion of community hand on hand. Help me to be clear and useful. Help me to help you. You are not my insurance, not my vacation, not my romance, not my job, not my garden. You wear your own flags and colors and your own names. I will never have you. I am a friend who loves you.
Thank you very much, Marge. I think that that is a very appropriate place to end. I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And I'm waiting for your next book, your next novel, and your next book of poetry.
Well, they're both in progress.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. And now we will close, as usual, with our theme song, which is Holly Near singing Sister, Woman, Sister.
Sister, woman, sister, can you still feel any pain? Or have they robbed you of your anger while putting Thorazina in your vein? Sister, woman, sister, have the walls grown up so high that you can't even dream of leaving, and you've forgotten how to fly? Oh, sister, woman, sister, did they take away your child? And they locked her up in some juvenile hall to grow up weary and wild. Oh, sister, woman, sister, they won't let me come and see you no more, but I still got the poem that you wrote me. It's hanging on my apartment door.